Interlude. Locke stays for dinner. 1. What? Locke nearly jumped to his feet. What are you talking about? My boy, said Chains, my intermittently brilliant little boy, your world has such small horizons. You can see clearly enough to pull a fast one on someone, but you can't see past the immediate consequences. Until you learn to think ahead of the repercussions, you are putting yourself and everyone around you in danger. You can't help being young, but it's past time that you stopped being stupid, so listen carefully. Your first mistake was that taking coin from the watch isn't a beating offence. It's a killing offence. Are we clear on that? Here in Camor, the watch takes our coin, and never the other way around. This rule is set in stone, and there are no exceptions, no matter what kind of thief you are. It's death. It's a throat-slashing, shark-feeding, off-to-meet-the-gods offence. Clear? Locke nodded. So when you set Veslin up, you really set him up. But you compounded this mistake when you used a white iron coin. You know how much a full crown is worth, exactly? Lots. Ah, lots isn't exactly. You don't speak Theron, or you don't really know.
I guess I don't really know.
Well, if everything's butter and nobody's been shaving the damn things, that little piece of shiny white iron was worth 40 silver solons. You see? 240 coppers. Your eyes are wide. That means you can think that big. That you understand?
Yes. Wow.
Yes. Wow. Let me put it in perspective. A yellow jacket, one of our selfless and infinitely dutiful city watchmen, might make that much for 2 months of daily duty. And watchmen are decently paid for common folk, and they sure as blessed shit do not get paid in white iron. Eh? So not only was Veslin taking money, he was taking too much money. A full crown. You can buy a death for much less, yours included.
How much did you pay for my...
Locke tapped his chest, where the death mark still hung beneath his shirt. I don't mean to prick your rather substantial opinion of yourself, but I'm still not sure if it was 2 coppers wisely spent. At the boy's expression, Chains barked out a rich, genuine laugh, but then his voice grew serious once again. Keep guessing, boy. But the point remains. You can get good, hard men to do serious work for less. You could buy 5 or 6 major pieces of business, if you know what I mean. So when you stuck a white iron coin in Veslin's things...
It was too much money for anything... simple?
Dead on. Far too much money for information or errands. Nobody in their right mind gives a fucking graveyard urchin a full crown. Unless that urchin is being paid to do something big. Kill your old master, for example. Smoke out all of Shades Hill and everyone in it. So if the poor thief-maker was upset to discover that Veslin was on the take, you can imagine how he felt when he saw how much money was involved. Locke nodded furiously. Ah, so, 2 mistakes. Your 3rd mistake was involving Gregor. Was Gregor supposed to get hit with the ugly stick?
I didn't like him, but no. I just wanted Veslin. Maybe I wanted Gregor to get a little, but not as much as Veslin.
Just so. You had a target, and you had a twist to play on that target, but you didn't control the situation. So your game for Veslin spilled over, and Gregor Foss got the knife too.
That's what I said, isn't it? I already admitted it.
Angry now? My, yes, you would be. Angry that you fucked up.
Angry that you're not as clever as you think. Angry that the gods gave lots of other people the same sort of brain they gave Locke Lamora. Quite the pisser, isn't it?
Locke blew his little lamp out with one quick breath, then flung it in an arc, as high over the parapet as his slender arm could throw. The crash of its landing was lost in the murmur of the busy Camorri night. The boy crossed his arms defensively.
Well, it certainly is nice to be free from the threat of that lamp, my boy.
Chains drew a last breath of smoke, then rubbed his dwindling sheaf of tobacco out against the roof stones.
Was it informing for the Duke, plotting to murder us?
Locke said nothing, teeth clenched and lower lip protruding. Petulance, the natural non-verbal language of the very young. Chains snorted.
I do believe everything you've told me, Locke, because I had a long talk with your former master before I took you off his hands. Like I said, he told me everything. He told me about your last and biggest mistake, the one that tipped him off and got you sent here. Can you guess what it might have been?
Locke shook his head.
Can't or won't?
I really don't know. Locke looked down. I hadn't actually thought about it.
You showed other kids in streets the white iron coin, didn't you? You had them help you look for it. You let some of them know what it might be used for, and you ordered them not to talk about it. But what did you, back that order up with?
Locke's eyes widened. His pout returned, but his petulance evaporated.
They hated Veslin too. They wanted to see him get it. Of course. Maybe that was enough for one day. But what about later? After Veslin was dead, and Gregor was dead, and your master had had a chance to cool down some and reflect on the situation? What if he started asking questions about a certain Lamora boy? What if he took some of your little boon companions from streets and asked them nicely if Locke Lamora had been up to anything unusual, even for him?
Oh, the boy winced.
Oh! Oh, ho, ho!
Chains reached out and slapped the boy on the shoulder.
Enlightenment! When it comes like a brick to the head, doesn't it?
I guess.
So, said Chains, now you see where everything went wrong. How many boys and girls are in that little hill, Locke? 100? 120? More? How many do you really think your old master could handle if they turned on him? 1 or 2, no problem, but 4? 8? All of them?
I guess we never thought about it.
Because he doesn't rule his graveyard by logic, boy. He rules it by fear. Fear of him keeps the older sprats in line. Fear of them keeps little shits like you in line. Anything that undermines that fear is a threat to his position. Enter Locke Lamora waving the idiot flag and thinking himself so much cleverer than the rest of the world.
I don't think I'm cleverer than the rest of the world.
You did until 3 minutes ago. Listen, I'm a garista. It means I run a gang, even if it's just a small one. Your old master is a garista too. The garista of Shades Hill. And when you mess with a leader's ability to rule his gang, out come the knives. How long do you think the thief maker could control Shades Hill if word got around of how you played him so sweetly? How you jerked him around like a kitten on a chain? He would never have real control over his orphans ever again. They'd push and push until it finally came to blood.
And that's why he got rid of me? But what about streets? What about the ones that helped me get Veslin?
Good questions. Easily answered. Your old master takes orphans in off the streets and keeps them for a few years. Usually he's through with them by the time they're 12 or 13. He teaches them the basics, how to sneak thief and speak the cant and mix with the right people, how to get along in a gang and how to dodge the noose. When he's through with them, he sells them to the bigger gangs, the real gangs. You see? He takes orders. Maybe the grey faces need a second-story girl. Maybe the Arsenal boys want a mean little bruiser. It's a great advantage to the gangs. It brings them suitable new recruits that don't need to have their hands held.
That I know. That's why he sold me to you.
Yes, because you're a very special case. You have profitable skills, even if your aim so far has been terrible. But your little friends in streets, did they have your gifts? They were just regular little coat charmers, simple little teasers. They weren't ripe. Nobody would give a penny for them except slavers, and your old master has one sad old scrap of real conscience. He wouldn't sell one of you to the crimpers for all the coin in Camor.
So what you're saying is he had to do something to all of us that knew about the coin, all of us that could figure it out or tell about it, and I was the only one he could sell.
Correct. And as for the others, well, Chains shrugged. It'll be quick. 2-3 weeks from now, nobody'll even remember their names. You know how it goes in the hill.
I got them killed?
Yes. Chains didn't soften his voice. You really did. As surely as you tried to hurt Veslin, you killed Gregor and 4 or 5 of your little comrades into the bargain.
Shit!
Do you see now what consequences really are? Why you have to move slowly, think ahead, control the situation? Why you need to settle down and wait for time to give you sense to match your talent for mischief? We have years to work together, Locke. Years for you and my other little hellions to practice quietly. And that has to be the rule if you want to stay here. No games, no cons, no scams, no anything except when and where I tell you. When someone like you pushes the world pushes back. Other people are likely to get hurt. Am I clear?
Locke nodded.
Now. Chains snapped his shoulders back and rolled his head from side to side. There was a series of snaps and cracks from somewhere inside him. Ah! Do you know what a death offering is?
No.
It's something we do for the benefactor. Not just those of us who are initiates of the 13th. Something all of us crooks do for one another. All the right people of Camor. When we lose someone we care about, we get something valuable and we throw it away. For real, you understand. Into the sea, into a fire, something like that. We do this to help our friends on their way to what comes next. Clear so far?
Yeah, but my old master...
Oh, he does it, trust me. He's a wretched miser, and he always does it in private, but he does it for each and every one of you he loses. Figures he wouldn't tell you about it, but here's the thing. There's a rule that has to be followed with the offering. It can't be given willingly, you understand? It can't be something you already have. It has to be something you go out and steal from someone else, special. Without their permission or their, complicity. Get me? It has to be genuine theft.
Sure.
Father Chains cracked his knuckles. You're going to make a death offering for every single boy or girl you got killed, Locke. One for Veslin, one for Gregor. One for each of your little friends in streets. I'm sure I'll know the count in just a day or two.
But I... They weren't... Of course they were your friends, Locke. They were your very good friends. Because they're going to teach you that when you kill someone, there are consequences. It is one thing to kill in a duel, to kill in self-defense, to kill for vengeance. It is another thing entirely to kill simply because you are careless. Those deaths are going to hang over your head until you're so careful you make the saints of Perelandro weep. Your death offering will be 1,000 full crowns per head. All of it properly stolen by your own hand.
But I... What? 1,000 crowns? Each? 1,000?
You can take that death mark off your neck when you offer up the last coin of it, and not a moment sooner.
But that's impossible. It'll take forever.
It'll take years. But we're thieves, not murderers, here in my temple. And the price of your life with me is that you must show respect for the dead. Those boys and girls are your victims, Locke. Get that through your head. This is something you owe them before the gods, something you must swear to by blood before you can stay. Are you willing to do so?
Locke seemed to think for a few seconds. Then he shook his head as though to clear it and nodded.
Then hold out your left hand.
As Locke did so, Chains produced a slender, blackened steel stiletto from within his robe and drew it across his own left palm. Then, holding Locke's outstretched hand firmly, he scratched a shallow, stinging cut between the boy's thumb and index finger. They shook hands firmly until their palms were thick with mingled blood.
Then you're a gentleman bastard, like the rest of us. I'm your garrista, and you're my pezon, my little soldier. I have your oath in blood to do what I've told you to do, to make the offerings for the souls of the people you've wronged.
I'll do it, Locke said.
Good. That means you can stay for dinner. Let's get down off this roof.
2. Behind the curtained door at the rear of the sanctuary, there was a grimy hall leading to several grimy rooms. Moisture and mould and poverty were on abundant display. There were cells with sleeping pallets, lit by oiled paper lamps that gave off a light the colour of cheap ale. Scrolls and bound books were scattered on the pallets. Robes in questionable states of cleanliness hung from wall hooks.
This is unnecessary nonsense.
Chains gestured to and fro as he led Locke into the room closest to the curtained door, as though showing off a palace.
Occasionally we play host to a tutor or a travelling priest of Perelandro's order, and they have to see what they expect.
Chains' own sleeping pallet, for Locke saw that the wall manacles in the other room could surely reach none of the other sleeping chambers back here, was set atop a block of solid stone, a sort of heavy shelf jutting from the wall. Chains reached under the stale blankets, turned something that made a metallic clacking noise, and lifted his bed up as though it were a coffin lid. The blankets turned out to be on some sort of wooden panel with hinges set into the stone. An inviting golden light spilled from within the stone block, along with the spicy smells of high-class Kamori cooking. Locke knew that aroma only from the way it drifted out of the Alchigrante district or down from certain inns and houses.
In you go!
Chains gestured once again, and Locke peeked over the lip of the stone block. A sturdy wooden ladder led down a square shaft, just slightly wider than Chains' shoulders. It ended about 20 feet below, on a polished wood floor.
Don't gawk! Climb!
Locke obeyed. The rungs of the ladder were wide and rough and very narrowly spaced. He had no trouble moving down it, and when he stepped off, he was in a tall passage that might have been torn out of the Duke's own tower. The floor was indeed polished wood, long, straight, golden-brown boards that creaked pleasantly beneath his feet.
The arched ceiling and the walls were entirely covered with a thick, milky golden glass that shone faintly, like a rainy season sun peeking out from behind heavy clouds. The illumination came from everywhere and nowhere. The walls scintillated. With a series of thumps and grunts and jingles, for Locke saw that he now carried the day's donated coins in a small burlap sack, chains came down and hopped to the floor beside him. He gave a quick tug to a rope tied to the ladder, and the false bed pallet fell back down and locked itself above.
There! Isn't this much nicer?
Yeah. Locke ran one hand down the flawless surface of one of the walls. The glass was noticeably cooler than the air. It's elder glass, isn't it?
Sure as hell isn't plaster.
Chains shooed Locke along the passage to the left, where it turned a corner. The whole temple cellar is surrounded by the stuff, sealed in it. The temple above was actually built to settle into it hundreds of years ago. There's not a break in it, as far as I can tell, except for one or two little tunnels that lead out to other interesting places. It's flood-tight and never lets in a drop from below, even when the water's waist-deep in the streets. And it keeps out rats and roaches and suckle spiders and all that crap, so long as we mind our comings and goings. The clatter of metal pans and the low giggle of the Sansa brothers reached them from around the corner just before they turned it, entering into a comfortably appointed kitchen with tall wooden cabinets and a long witchwood table surrounded by high-backed chairs. Locke actually rubbed his eyes when he saw their black velvet cushions and the varnished gold leaf that gilded their every surface. Carlo and Galdo were working at a brick cooking shelf, shuffling pans and banging knives over a huge white alchemical hearth slab. Locke had seen smaller blocks of this stone, which gave off a smokeless heat when water was splashed atop it, but this one must have weighed as much as Father Chain's. As Locke watched, Carlo, Galdo, held a pan in the air and poured water from a glass pitcher onto the sizzling slab. The great uprush of steam carried a deep bouquet of sweet cooking smells, and Locke felt saliva spilling down the back of his mouth. In the air over the witchwood table, a striking chandelier blazed. Locke would, in later years, come to recognize it as an armillary sphere, fashioned from glass with an axis of solid gold. At its heart shone an alchemical globe with the white bronze light of the sun. Surrounding this were the concentric glass rings that marked the orbits and precessions of the world and all her celestial cousins, including the three moons. At the outermost edges were 100 dangling stars that looked like spatters of molten glass, somehow frozen at the very instant of their outward explosions. The light ran and glimmered and burned along every facet of the chandelier, yet there was something wrong about it. It was as if the elder glass ceilings and walls were somehow drawing the light out of the alchemical sun, leavening it, weakening it, redistributing it along the full length and breadth of all the elder glass in this uncanny cellar.
Welcome to our real home, our little temple to the benefactor.
Chains tossed his bag of coins down on the table.
Our patron has always sort of danced upon the notion that austerity and piety go hand in hand. Down here, we show our appreciation for things by appreciating, if you get me. Boys, look who survived his interview.
We never doubted, said one twin. For even a second, said the other. But now can we hear what he did to get himself kicked out of Shades Hill?
The question, spoken in near perfect unison, had the ring of repeated ritual.
When you're older.
Chains raised his eyebrows at Locke and shook his head, ensuring the boy could see the gesture clearly.
Much older.
Locke, I don't expect that you know how to set a table. When Locke shook his head, Chains led him over to a tall cabinet just to the left of the cooking hearth. Inside were stacks of white porcelain plates.
Chains held one up so Locke could see the hand-painted heraldic design, a mailed fist clutching an arrow and a grapevine, and the bright gold gilding on the rim.
"Borrowed," said Chains, "on a rather permanent basis from Doña Isabella Manichezzo, the old dowager aunt of our own Duke Nicovante. She died childless and rarely gave parties, so it wasn't as though she was using them all. You see how some of our acts that might seem purely cruel and larcenous to outsiders are actually sort of convenient if you look at them in the right way? That's the hand of the benefactor at work, or so we like to think. It's not as though we could tell the difference if he didn't want us to." Chains handed the plate to Locke, who clutched at it with greatly exaggerated care and peered very closely at the gold rim and ran his right hand lovingly over the surface of the witchwood table. "Now this used to be the property of Marius Cordo, a master merchant of Tal Verar. He had it in the great cabin of a triple-decker galley. Huge! 86 oars. I was a bit upset with him, so I lifted it, his chairs, his carpets and tapestries, and all of his clothes, right off the ship. I left his money. I was making a point. I dumped everything but the table into the sea of brass. And that," Chains lifted a finger in the direction of the celestial chandelier, "that was being shipped overland from Ashmere in a guarded wagon convoy for the old Don Leviana. Somehow, in transit, it transformed itself into a box of straw." Chains took three more plates out of the cabinet and set them in Locke's arms. "Damn, I was fairly good back when I actually worked for a living." "Urk," said Locke, under the weight of the fine dinnerware. "Oh, yeah." Chains gestured to the chair at the head of the table. "Put one there for me. One for yourself on my left. Two for Carlo and Galdo on my right. If you were my servant, what I'd tell you to lay out is a casual setting. Can you say that for me?"
"A casual setting."
"Right. This is how the high and mighty eat when it's just close blood and maybe a friend or two." Chains let the set of his eyes and the tone of his voice suggest that he expected this lesson to be retained, and he began to introduce Locke to the intricacies of glasses, linen napkins, and silver eating utensils.
"What kind of knife is this?"
Locke held a rounded buttering utensil up for Chains' inspection.
"It's all wrong. You couldn't kill anyone with this."
"Well, not very easily, I'll grant you that, my boy."
Chains guided Locke in the placement of the butter knife and assorted small dishes and bowls. "But when the quality get together to dine, it's impolite to knock anybody off with anything but poison. That thing is for scooping butter, not slicing windpipes."
"This is a lot of trouble to go to just to eat."
"Well, in Shades Hill, you may be able to eat cold bacon and dirt pies off one another's asses for all your old master cares. But now you're a gentleman bastard. Emphasis on the gentleman. You're going to learn how to eat like this and how to serve people who eat like this."
"Why?"
"Because, Locke Lamora, someday you're going to dine with barons and counts and dukes. You're going to dine with merchants and admirals and generals and ladies of every sort. And when you do..."
Chains put two fingers under Locke's chin and tilted the boy's head up so they were eye to eye.
"When you do, those poor idiots won't have any idea that they're really dining with a thief."
3.
"Now, isn't this lovely?"
Chains raised an empty glass and saluted his three young wards at the splendidly furnished table. Steaming brass bowls and heavy crockware held the results of Carlo and Galdo's efforts at the cooking hearth.
Locke, seated on an extra cushion to raise his elbows just above the tabletop, stared at the food and the furnishings with wide eyes. He was bewildered at how quickly he had escaped his old life and fallen into this new one with strangely pleasant, crazy people. Chains lifted a bottle of something he'd called alchemical wine. The stuff was viscous and dark, like quicksilver. When he pulled the loosened cork, the air was filled with the scent of juniper. For a brief moment, it overwhelmed the spicy aroma of the main dishes. Chains poured a good measure of the stuff into the empty glass, and in the bright light it ran like molten silver. Chains raised the glass to a level with his eyes. "A glass poured to air for the one who sits with us unseen, the patron and protector, the crooked warden, the father of necessary pretexts."
"Thanks for deep pockets, poorly guarded," said the Sansa brothers in unison, and Locke was caught off guard by the seriousness of their intonation.
"Thanks for watchmen asleep at their posts," said Chains.
"Thanks for the city to nurture us and the night to hide us," was the response.
"Thanks for friends to help spend the loot." Chains brought the half-filled glass down and set it in the middle of the table. He took up another smaller glass. Into this he poured just a finger of the liquid silver. "A glass poured to air for an absent friend. We wish Sabitha well and pray for her safe return."
"Maybe we could have her back a little less crazy, though," said one of the Sansas, whom Locke mentally labelled Carlo for convenience. "And humble," Galdo nodded after he'd said this. "Humble would be really great."
"The brothers Sansa wish Sabitha well." Chains held the little glass of liquor rock steady and eyed the twins. "And they pray for her safe return."
"Yes, wish her well. Safe return, that would be really great."
"Who's Sabitha?"
Locke spoke quietly, directing his inquiry to Chains. "An ornament to our little gang. Our only young woman, currently away on educational business." Chains set her glass down beside the one poured to the benefactor and plucked up Locke's glass in exchange. "Another special deal from your old master. Gifted, my boy, gifted like you are with a preternatural talent for the vexation of others."
"That's us he's talking about," said Carlo. "Pretty soon it'll mean you too,"
Galdo smiled. "Pipe down, twitlings." Chains poured a splash of the quicksilver wine into Locke's glass and handed it back to him. "One more toast and prayer. To Locke Lamora, our new brother, my new Pezon. We wish him well. We welcome him warmly. And for him, we pray, wisdom."
With graceful motions, he poured wine for Carlo and Galdo, and then a nearly full glass for himself. Chains and the Sansas raised their glasses. Locke quickly copied them. Silver sparkled under gold.
"Welcome to the gentlemen bastards."
Chains tapped his glass gently against Locke's, producing a ringing sound that hung in the air before fading sweetly.
"You should have picked death," said Galdo. "He did offer you death as a choice, right?"
Carlo spoke as he and his brother tapped their own glasses together, then reached across the table in unison to touch Locke's.
"Laugh it up, boys."
Soon all the knocking about with glasses was finished, and Chains led the way with a quick sip of his wine.
"Ah, mark my words, if this poor little creature lives a year, you two will be his dancing monkeys. He'll throw you grapes whenever he wants to see a trick. Go ahead and have a drink, Locke."
Locke raised the glass. The silvery surface showed him a vivid but wobbly reflection of his own face and the brightly lit room around him. The wine's bouquet was a haze of juniper and anise that tickled his nose. He put the tiny image of himself to his lips and drank. The slightly cool liquor seemed to go two ways at once as he swallowed.
A line of tickling warmth ran straight down his throat, while icy tendrils reached upward, sliding across the roof of his mouth and into his sinuses. His eyes bulged. He coughed and ran a hand over his suddenly numb lips. "It's mirror wine from Tal Verar. Good stuff. Now go ahead and eat something, or it'll pop your skull open." Carlo and Galdo whisked damp cloths off serving platters and bowls, revealing the full extent of the meal for the first time. There were indeed sausages, neatly sliced and fried in oil with quartered pears. There were also split red peppers stuffed with almond paste and spinach, dumplings of thin bread folded over chicken, fried until the bread was as translucent as paper, and cold black beans in wine and mustard sauce. The Sansa brothers were suddenly scooping portions of this and that onto Locke's plate, too fast for him to track. Working awkwardly with a two-pronged silver fork and one of the rounded knives he'd previously scorned, Locke began to shovel things into his mouth. The flavors seemed to burst gloriously, haphazardly. The chicken dumplings were spiced with ginger and ground orange peels. The wine sauce in the bean salad warmed his tongue. The sharp fumes of mustard burned his throat. He found himself gulping wine to put out each new fire as it arose. To his surprise, the Sansa twins didn't partake once they'd served him. They sat with their hands folded, watching Chains. When the older man seemed assured that Locke was eating, he turned to Carlo. "You're a Vardran noble. Let's say you're a liege graf from one of the less important marrows. You're at a dinner party in Tal Verar. An equal number of men and women with assigned seating. The party is just entering the dining hall. Your assigned lady is beside you as you enter, conversing with you. What do you do?"
"At a Vardran dinner party, I would hold her chair out for her without invitation."
Carlo didn't smile.
"But Verari ladies will stand beside a chair to show they want it pulled out. It's impolite to presume, so I'd let her make the first move."
"Very good. Now," Chains pointed to the second Sansa with one hand as he began adding food to his plate with the other. "What's 17 multiplied by 19?
Galdo closed his eyes in concentration for a few seconds.
323.
"Correct. What's the difference between a Vardran Nautical League and a Therin Nautical League?"
The Vardran League is 150 yards longer.
"Very good. That's that, then. Go and eat."
As the Sansa brothers began to undecorously struggle for possession of certain serving dishes, Chains turned to Locke, whose plate was already half empty.
"After you've been here a few days, I'm going to start asking questions about what you've learned, too. If you want to eat, you'll be expected to learn."
"What am I going to learn, other than setting tables?"
"Everything."
Chains looked very pleased with himself.
"Everything, my boy. How to fight, how to steal, how to lie with a straight face, how to cook meals like this, how to disguise yourself, how to speak like a noble, how to scribe like a priest, how to skulk like a half-wit."
"Carlo already knows that one," said Galdo.
"Agmo agnamabra,"
said Carlo around a mouthful of food.
"Remember what I said when I told you we didn't work like other thieves work? We're a new sort of thief here, Locke. What we are is actors, false facers. I sit here and pretend to be a priest of Perelandro. For years now, people have been throwing money at me. How do you think I paid to furnish this little fairy burrow, this food? I'm 53. Nobody my age can steal around rooftops and charm locks. I'm better paid for being blind than I ever was for being quick and clever. And now I'm too slow and too round to pass for anything really interesting."
Chains finished off the contents of his glass and poured another.
"But you and Carlo and Galdo and Sabatha, you four will have every advantage I didn't. Your education will be thorough and vigorous.
I'll refine my notions, my techniques. When I'm finished, the things you four will pull, well, they'll make my little scam with this temple look simple and unambitious."
"That sounds nice," said Locke, who was feeling the wine. A warm haze of charitable contentment was descending over him and smothering the tension and worry that was so second nature to a Shades Hill orphan.
"What do we do first?"
"Well, tonight, if you're not busy throwing up the first decent meal you've ever had, Carlo and Galdo will draw you a bath. Once you're less aromatic company, you can sleep in. Tomorrow, we'll get you an acolyte's robe and you can sit the steps with us, taking coins. Tomorrow night," Chains scratched at his beard while he took a sip from his glass, "I take you to meet the big man, Kappa Barsavi. He's ever so curious to get a look at you."